Can you hear that? Okay, great. Sorry about that. I had a hard time fitting these things on with the huge, you know, the huge characters. I sort of felt like I was coding for the phone, you know. Everybody's going to watch this on their phone. So this one is about file stream and file table in 2012. File stream was actually invented in SQL Server 2008. They did some upgrades to it in 2008 release 2, and they've done some more upgrades to it in 2012. But it turns out that one of the things that they've done with file stream is to layer file table over it. Now, I really think that that was their intent all along, but they hadn't got to the file table part of it before 2008 came out, so they had to ship what they had. And then they shipped the rest of it afterwards in 2012. So I'm going to do a file stream demo, a file table demo, talk a little bit about the internals of how file table works, some of the repercussions of using file table, and we'll do everything that we can do with file table except to do full text search with it. So let me tell you my real idea of what this feature is about. Anybody remember an operating system that a file system that Microsoft used to have called WinFS that never quite made it to fruition? And what could you use WinFS for? You could use it to search on properties, right? If I have, sorry, this is an aside, but too bad, right? If I have a file like this and it has properties on it, I can go into the extended properties, details of the extended properties. I have to bring up my, sorry, this is terrible. I lost my zoom it thing. There we go. So now I can zoom. Okay. So if we have extended properties like this, for this particular file type, we have a bunch of extended properties. But if I have music, for example, or if I have pictures, they have different extended properties. In fact, go put some pictures in Windows that you took with a GPS camera, and it'll show all the GPS properties, all the camera properties, everything else. Well, here's my question. How do you search on those properties? Is there a property search you can do in the Windows operating system to search on those properties? And it turns out there's not really one at all. And this was my idea of what WinFS was supposed to do. It was allow you to search on the extended properties. So today I'm going to talk about file stream and file table. File table makes up basically something that looks like a share, but actually lives over file stream. And then tomorrow I'm going to talk about full text search property search. Because guess what? All these features really came from, I was told, the WinFS team. And the only reason I know that is because I asked. So I don't want to be any ruder about it than that, but I think they're just inventing WinFS all over again. Now, that's my disclaimer. I don't work for Microsoft, and so none of this is real. It's just a figment of my imagination, but it sure looks a lot like WinFS. All right, so we've seen that already, right? If you came to the one after lunch, you've seen that, and I don't have to go through all this stuff. Good. That's who I am. The demos for this session and all the other sessions that I give are going to be up on the SQL Skills website because it's just easier to put them up there. So that's www.sqlskills.com, and then you look at previous conferences. And at the end of this week, this will be a previous conference. This will just be a smile on my face, right? And the demos should all be out there as soon as I can harass somebody to put them up. Okay. And the slides will actually appear. I'll have to give them to these guys tomorrow. So I'm going to talk about 2008 file stream, some enhancements for file stream, and then file table. So there had always been this big uproar about where it was best to put large data. So if you had pictures and you were going to serve them off your web server, or if you wanted to store architectural drawings, engineering drawings, where would you put those things? Would you put them on the file system or would you put them in SQL Server or database? And one of the nice reasons why you might want to put them in a file system is because large objects take up a lot of memory buffers. And you don't really want to be using all SQL Server's memory buffers with large objects that you use. Another reason is that large objects in a database can cause database fragmentation. So if you have a picture of every employee in the database and those pictures get updated every 6 months or so, that's eventually going to cause fragmentation in the database. So because of that, really the biggest one, I don't think I might even have this on the slide, but the biggest problem, if you think about it, is because your database is transactional, when you insert a file into a database row, you're actually inserting it twice, right? Once in the database itself and once in the transaction log. And if you do any changes to it, you're inserting changes in the transaction log. And if those are huge files, you're going to blow out your transaction log. Or conceivably, you could blow out your transaction log, right? So the reason why people want these in a database is to have transactional consistency and point-in-time recovery, especially point-in-time recovery. If you've ever tried to point-in-time recover a database and some files on the file system to a specific point in time, that's not even possible. Right, so it'd be nice to have all that stuff in the database, because we got these special people called database administrators on our side, and they take care of everything, and they're really paranoid. They take calls in the middle of the night and all this stuff. So we want those people taking care of all of our data. We also want to be able to query it. How do you query if the properties are in a SQL Server database, but the actual data you want to query is on the file system? Do you hook something up with an OLEDB provider for, you know, Microsoft Search Service, or how exactly do you do this? So once upon a time, when they decided that this was a big enough issue, Jim Gray and a couple people from Stanford, I think this was one of the last things Jim Gray worked on, actually worked on a white paper for this particular problem. And they did a performance study called To Blob or Not to Blob. And all you have to do is read the summary of it. In the summary, it says that the break-even point is 256 kilobytes, not megabytes, right, but kilobytes. So anything larger than 256 kilobytes really should be on the file system. It shouldn't really be in the database. But we want to use those things in the database because we need them for single storage and query vehicle. We want to be able to query them as well. So how do we, you know, do this? So in SQL Server 2008, they invented something called FileStream. And basically, FileStream is a database file system hybrid. The data actually lives out on the file system. They have a separate transaction log that they log what files have been added and what files have been updated, what files have been deleted in this transaction log. It's synchronized with the SQL Server transaction log. And basically what this means in terms of reality is the files live out on the file system, but SQL Server thinks they're part of the database. In fact, at the beginning of 2008, I did this talk about FileStream, and a guy came up to me after the talk and he said, "Hey, Bob, they can't possibly belong to the database because I took a file that I put out on a file stream and I edited it in Notepad and then I saved it back and it didn't hit my trigger that I had." And it's like, and you expected it to hit the trigger, didn't you? I said, and so in order to update the data in the database, do you also take out the MDF file and edit it in Notepad? Is that a good idea? I said, once you put those files in there, they're part of the database. And you're lucky you didn't get the database corruption error, because what you did was totally outside of the database's control. That's not a good idea to do that. Right? So he goes, well, how am I going to use these files? Good question. That's, by the way, what file table's about. So anyway, let's just make a file stream, because it's late and you guys would probably see rather than listen to me talk. Okay, so I have some couple file stream demos in here somewhere. Let's go back and see, he said. Under scripts, there. Okay, so let's do the add a file stream to Northwind thing. Okay, so because you're using the file system, and because if you want people to remotely access the file system, you have to do things that are against security. The things you're doing that are against security is to open up port 445 on a SQL Server machine. 445 is the file sharing port, and it's usually not a good idea to open the file sharing port on a SQL Server machine. Be that as it may, the security people are working on writing a white paper that covers this, and I'm supposed to, when I write the security best practices white paper, point to their white paper, but their white paper isn't done yet. So anyway, the first person you have to go through to get this to work is you have to go through your system administrator. And they designed this feature in mind with the fact that the system administrator might not be the database administrator, vice versa, right? The database administrator isn't going to be the system administrator. So the point is that you either install this feature at installation time. When you install SQL Server, one of the things you can say is, do you want to support FileStream? Yes, no, or maybe. And you can install it then. Or you can have your system administrator go in and actually configure it his or herself. And the way that you would do that is with the SQL Server Configuration Manager, this guy down here. And so let's go up to the, oh, nice. Let's not write on the board there. Let's go up to the SQL Server Configuration Manager, bring it up. And I'll show you where it is that you can configure it if you didn't install it already. Right, and the premise of best practice for security installation in SQL Server is don't install anything you don't need, so you may not have installed it. So I have this utility, and if I go to the tree for SQL Server services, I get the SQL Server services that run on your machine. By the way, this utility is basically just a WMI-based utility. It's a GUI over the WMI provider for SQL Server. So conceivably, you could do all this stuff in PowerShell and WMI if you wanted to. And you might want to, because this utility, one of its main drawbacks is that it doesn't actually look at things other than your local SQL Server. And if you're a DBA that has to configure 50 of these, I don't want to be going to every server. Let me write a script and use like PowerShell remoting or something to do it. But anyway, we'll do it in the GUI because I'm obnoxious. So you click on your SQL Server service and you open up properties for it, and it's something that looks like services in the don't bring up help. I just hit the thing. There we go. Stop. Good. You come up with something that looks like services in the control panel. But when you actually look at it, it's not the same information as services in the control panel. Some of the information is similar, like the login, but some of it is SQL Server specific, like always on, high availability, or right over here in the corner you can see file stream. So let's see what we can configure with file stream in this. So as a system administrator, we have four choices as far as configuring file stream. If you don't configure it, it's this choice. It's off by default. You can't use file stream. If you try and define a file stream file group, it says it's turned off. Go contact your system administrator, do something about it. So one thing the sysadmin can do is say, I only want file stream, but you only have transact SQL access. You don't have access directly to the files, only through transact SQL. And they show up in transact SQL as though they're just var binary max columns, right? The second thing you can do is say, I want to enable file stream for file IO access. You can actually load the rows faster if you use file IO access. But one of the things, again, about file IO access is that you have to allow people access to your SQL Server. And that may not be your SQL Server machine, OS and all. And that may not be what you want. But in this case, what this configuration says is, I can use SQL, that's fine. I can use file stream to the file system version of this. But the only way that I can get to the file system is to actually be on the local SQL Server machine. Well, that's fairly useless because it's a best practice not to run SQL Server in the application on the same machine. Right? Every time I talk about this at Microsoft, everybody shakes their head and goes, don't do that. Okay, fine. So we'll go to the third option, which says allow remote clients to access the file stream. And this is where you have to open port, what is it, 129 and 445? 129 is the COM object resolution port, and 445 is the file sharing port. And your system administrator may not like that. Be that as it may, I'm the system administrator on this machine, so it's all open. So now that my system administrator has been so accommodating, let's go and see what you have to do as a database administrator. As a database administrator, you have to do somewhat of the same thing. Doesn't have to be done in the database where you're going to use it. But you can configure the instance for file stream access level. And for file stream access level, they don't distinguish, as far as the database administrator goes, between remote access to the file and local access to the file. So you have a choice of 0, it doesn't work. 1, it only works through transact SQL. And 2, it works through transact SQL or file IO. Everybody okay, happy with that? So of course you probably guessed that I've already configured this, but I'm going to configure it again. If it doesn't configure again, you know there's something wrong. Okay, so now I'm all set. So the next thing that I can do is I can alter the database or I can make up a new one with a specific file group named a certain name that contains file stream. Notice that that DDL statement doesn't say where on the system the files will live. So let's say where on the system the files will live. So in this case, there's a variation of alter database, and we're doing this for Northwind, to add a file, and the name of the file ought to be photos, and the file name should be cfiles photos. So what it's going to do out there is make up a directory structure with its own directory and its own log to keep track of all the files I put on the file system. But remember, I can put them there through transact SQL if I want to. Okay, great. Now it turns out the weird part of this is that cfiles must already exist and cfiles photos cannot already exist. So hopefully I have a cfiles out here someplace before I try and do this. So there's c, and under c, oh, amazingly, there are files. Okay, surprise. Hopefully I didn't do this demo before all the way. Let's see. Go. Okay, good. So now what do I have? Well, let's go look. So in cfiles in my file system, under photos, right here. There's photos, and notice that under the photos directory, it doesn't look like I have much. I have one called FileStream HDR, which is a FileStream binary header that gives them information that they need to use to access the FileStream. And then there's also a directory called $fslog, which is where it actually keeps its log for FileStream, which is coordinated, by the way, with the SQL Server log. You can do point-in-time recovery right back to a specific point in time with both the files on the file system that you're using through FileStream and the rest of the database. They keep it synchronized. By the way, the big gotcha with this that I've never seen anybody explain to anything that I can use is that you can't detach and reattach a database with FileStream. If anybody knows how to do that, let me know. I actually went to Paul Randall, who was the guy that wrote the white paper for FileStream, and he goes, "Did you try that? What if you put the files out there already?" And it's like, well, then I'm not really restoring to a, you know, I'm not attaching it. But see if it'll attach then. It didn't. Okay, but that's all I have here right now is an empty log and an empty header. So now what I have to do is I have to use the file stream in the Northwind database. So let's create something that uses it. Okay, here's the something that uses it. So there is already in Northwind a table called employees, and I've made up another table called employees 2. In the original employees table, there was a column called photo. There it is right there. And in the original employees, there was a column called photo whose data type was image. And so this is to 1999 for anybody. And so what I like to do is I'd like to change it to var binary max. Great. So change it to var binary max, and not only do that, but you put on the file stream property on that column. The file stream property basically allows you to say that that's a file stream column, and when you store to that column, when you insert, it will insert the file into the file system rather than inserting things into an MDF file, a database file. And it will use the FS log rather than the SQL Server log, so it won't fill up your log either. Now, there's one more other weird requirement, and that's that you must have a column. Either you have one or you can use a new one. And that column must have a unique identifier data type and have the rowGuidCall property. There's the rowGuidCall property. You can only have one of those per table. If you already have one in your table, you can use that one. That's fine. But if you don't, you have to add one in. And this is what SQL Server uses to derive the value of the derive the table of the file stream, the name of the file stream file on disk. You'll see when we put some files on disk what this looks like. Everybody okay so far? Great. So let's make up this table. And then we make up the table, I want to go back and see what my file system looks like. By the way, I didn't mention this, so let me mention it in passing. When you use file stream, you have to put the files on a local drive. In other words, they can't be someplace out on the network with a UNC name. If you have a SAN vendor who can convince SQL Server that their SAN is a local drive, or if you have a NAS vendor that you can do that can do that, right, network addressable storage, then as long as SQL Server thinks it's a local drive, you can put your files there. But if not, you can't put them on any old network share. Everybody okay with that? Yes, sir. Is it possible in Azure? They don't have FileStream in Azure mostly because that would give you too much visibility into what they're doing. Right? You would have to know where on the file system to put it, and in Azure you know nothing about anything that's going on. Right? By the way, I will do an Azure talk tomorrow. You've probably already seen that one. It's on federations, or seen that I'm doing it. I haven't done it before, so. Okay. So there. Now we have a table. So let's go back and look at our file system and see what we have in our file system, and lo and behold, we have something different. So now instead of $fslog and FileStream header, we also have this directory that's named after a GUID. What's the directory for? Well, the directory is because I put a FileStream node on my database, so this is all the files for that particular table. Everybody okay with that? One subdirectory per table, and it's named with a GUID. Now, under that, I have a directory with a GUID. What's the directory with a GUID? Well, conceivably, you could have more than one file stream column in the same table. And so this is basically first table with a file stream column, first file stream column in the table. In other words, if I had two columns, I'd have another directory here. And if I had two tables, I'd have another directory here. Great, no sweat. So anything else in there? No, it's empty because I don't have any rows. So let's put some rows in and see what it does. So we actually put some things in here. And because it's an identity column, we'll put identity insert on, big deal. And then we'll do an insert into. And the only thing I had to do to make this work, to insert it into the old new table from the old data, was to actually do a convert from image to var binary max. Interesting thing about that conversion from image to var binary max. The maximum length of data that you can put inside an image column is what? 2 gigabytes, right? How about the var binary max? 2 gigabytes. When you store it on the file system, is there a limit of 2 gigabytes? No, there isn't. Right, so when you store the data on the file system, you can actually have more than 2 gigabytes in a single column. You can put an entire video out there if you wanted to. Right, that was multiple gigabytes long. And in fact, I was surprised about this because I had seen back in 2008, if you actually asked SQL Server for the length of a var binary max, it told you the length was -1. I couldn't figure out what the -1 was about because it looked like 2 gigabytes to me. And it turned out this ruined one of my clients' programs. But anyway, back to file stream. Okay, so let's insert some rows in there. There's only 7 of them. Oh, 9, I lied. Okay, so if I have 9 in there, let's go and back and look in my file system. And sure enough, I have 9 files. But what ugly files. I mean, first of all, they're named after GUIDs. So how am I going to know what the name of anything was? Well, I just inserted rows. They didn't have a name. Yeah, I realize that. But how am I going to figure out what the name of it is if I want them to, you know, use? I want to read them later. Because supposedly I can use file.io. And the deal is, the way this works is that it'll put files out there with outrageous-looking GUIDs under them. And then in order to get a file path that you can open to get a handle from that file, to be able to use file.io, you have to ask SQL Server for that path. So you say to SQL Server, I would like you to get me the path for row number 5, and it gives you back a path, and you can use that path with a specific object that they have in .NET called system.data.sqltypes.sqlfilestream to open what looks like a file to you. Is everybody okay with that? And you have to go through all that nonsense, and it also has to be within the context of a transaction. Because if they're going to do point-in-time recovery between the file system and SQL Server, then how are they going to do that if you don't have transactional file system? And I know that Windows NT has transactional file system, but FileStream doesn't use it. Oh, great. Because its log is not SQL Server's log. Okay. And by the way, of course, the biggest problem that people have with these, they ask me all the time, is how do I open it with whatever program I want to open it with? And the answer is you don't. It's all hidden from you. In fact, somebody said, well, how can I open this with Notepad? It doesn't end with .txt. And I said, you wouldn't want to open it with Notepad. You'd want to write your own transactional Notepad and open it with that. And he said, well, do you have the source code for transactional Notepad on you? And I said, no. And he said, well, who's going to use this feature? Good question, right? It actually turns out that the people that do use this feature right now this way are the SharePoint people. Everybody okay with that so far? So now you know how FileStream works. How do you get to FileStream? Well, I can get to it with SQL, right? I can do a select star from employees 2, because that's all I know how to do, right, is select star. I know the guy in the last talk was talking about that. Right, okay, so there's employees 2, and there's the photo. And actually, it turns out it's a little bit slower to get that information through Transact SQL. If I want to go fast, I have to use the file system and file.io, and how do I do that? Well, here's just one .NET example. I'm going to give you all these examples anyway. And I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, as usual. But here's a .NET example of how you'd go get that. So let's go and read a row. Okay, here's the read a row in .NET. Up comes Visual Studio sometime in my lifetime. And basically what I'm going to do here is I'm going to start a transaction. I'm going to go into SQL Server and I'm going to get metadata. What's the metadata? The path name. And then I'm going to take the path name and the transaction token, because it has to be a transaction. And I'm going to use the path name and the transaction token to open the file. Really? That sounds like a lot of extra work. Well, it is. So here's the code. I'm not even going to run this code, but just to see how much work you have to do to open the file, he said. And yes, I did write this one. I didn't get it off the books online. Right? Here's a transaction, read committed, right? And I'm going to associate the transaction with the command. And all I'm going to do is read one row, and I have to get two pieces of information. I have to get the file stream transaction context, which returns me a transaction token, just like SQL Server uses internally, and I also have to get the path name of the file. That's the only way that I can open the file, is get all this information from SQL Server, and then once I've got that information from SQL Server right here, I can use the information to open up a new SQL file stream right down here. This is the .NET class that they made up to correspond to file stream. And file stream open, notice, takes the path, which you've gotten from SQL Server. It takes the transaction token, which is that second one, byte array, and then whatever file accesses you want. And it can't do everything that the real file system can do. For example, it can't do memory map files. So if you were thinking of writing your own transactional notepad, and notepad does memory map files, you better think of some other way to do it, because he's not going to support memory map files. Everybody okay with that? But once I've got that, then I can use file.io to read the file. The nice thing is that it doesn't drag all the buffers through SQL Server's buffer pool. So I'm going to drag all the buffers through SQL Server's buffer pool. I'm going to waste a lot of buffer pool. Everybody okay with that? And it's just as fun to insert the row. Right, to insert the row, you actually have to write an insert statement that inserts it into SQL and insert an empty string into the var binary max, because if you insert null into the var binary max, it doesn't make a file. So make an empty string, insert that into the var binary max, get the handle back from SQL Server, and use that to write the file. It turns out that's the thing it's best at, is to write the file. And if this sounds like too much work, it is too much work, right? So this is probably one of the reasons why you may be at this talk, is because you thought the feature was interesting, but nobody would dare to use it, because it seems like it was too much work. To go over all of this, a file stream for file stream storage is declared by using DDL. The file stream storage is tied to a database. The file group is mapped to a directory, NTFS directory, on the local file system. Somebody said to me once, what's to keep the DBA from going in and deleting those files? And the answer is nothing, right? If you're a DBA, you better know that those files are out there. Oracle at one point had an analogous thing called bfile, and I've heard a specific Oracle DBA, which I won't name, once deleted the bfiles because she didn't know what they were. Nobody had told her that they were using bfiles. Anyway, one way you can do this is DACL yourself out of that directory. The directory is only DACL to the system administrator and the SQL Server service account. That'll keep the DBA out, right? Unless the DBA is the system administrator, then you're in trouble. You define var binary max with the file stream attribute, and the columns data is actually stored in the file system. It's not in the MDF file at all. It gets backed up. You can do a file group-based backup, so you don't have to back up your files every time, but it gets backed up as part of database backup. How to set it up? Well, we just set it up. So you ask your system administrator to do this. You ask your database administrator to do that. And then at the column level, you use the var binary max data type with the file stream attribute. Interesting thing about this, by the way, select into with a file stream column does not produce a file stream column, just so you know, right? It produces a real column, so don't play select into and hope it'll make a file stream column. It won't. And it'll take up all your transaction log. Yes, sir? No, unfortunately it isn't. And when I asked the guys why this, so the question was, if you didn't hear it, is it possible to use other data types other than var binary max? Because maybe I want to use varchar max, nvarchar max, XML might be a good candidate for it. And they said no, they weren't going to do that. And the reason supposedly why they didn't do it is because in character-based data type, you have collation problems to worry about. And they didn't want to worry about the collation problems for you. In fact, they had no way to enforce the collation if you put in things through the file system. So they decided not to do that. And XML, I just think they didn't like XML. Oh, well. Maybe they don't like XML. Yes, sir? Okay. How much disk space does it take in the MDF file? It's basically just a handle. So I think it might be 23 bytes, but I'd have to actually go and check that. Paul Randall wrote a nice white paper about 20 pages or so on the internals of FileStream, and so he would know that exactly. The other interesting thing that I found out from this white paper is that, you know those GUIDs that they use as the names of the files? Those aren't the same as the GUIDs that are in the GUID column, right? the GUIDs are different from the GUIDs that they put in the GUID column. They take the GUID that you have in the unique identifier column, and they use an algorithm on it to make another GUID, and they use that for the file name. Just to upset people? But anyway, that white paper should have that. If they don't, send me mail and I'll ask Paul, and he'll go and do it for me. Right, that's nice about working with the people that have the white papers. It's like, yeah, I'll ask him that. Of course, he was the same guy I asked if you could attach it, but we won't go there, right? Okay. So how do you program with these? So it's available through Transact SQL, right? There's no way that you can have file stream access only and no Transact SQL access, so you can always get to it through Transact SQL, no sweat. OADB and ODBC, they actually have an API call called OpenSQL FileStream, and actually have an OADB version, an ODBC example program using file streams. For anybody that's a masochist, you can look at this program, right? Basically, it gives you back something that looks like a file handle, right? But it's a file handle you can't do everything with. ADO.NET has its own system.data.sqltypes.sql file stream, which is the one I showed you before. And the big hassle if you're using Link to SQL or Entity Framework is that Link to SQL or Entity Framework don't support direct file IO for these things. They just get them through SQL. So they're always using SQL. They're never using file IO. In fact, I don't know if there's anybody that invented a kludge around for that, but there might be by this point. Okay. So file stream programming, you've seen that already, right? You get two pieces of information, the path name and the file stream transaction context, and you go use that to go and get your file. And that's tedious and awful and boring, but you can do it. Okay. So they made some enhancements to this feature after SQL Server 2008 and before 2012. Between 2008 and 2008 release 2, somebody realized, me and a few other people, that if you use FileStream in a database, one of the main problems with using FileStream in a database is now you cannot turn on any of the transaction isolation settings for Snapshot. It forbade you from using Snapshot isolation. Now, I didn't see any big whales of terror after that, so I guess not a whole lot of people are using Snapshot isolation. But it was a big deal with the people that I work with that you have to be able to use Snapshot isolation with FileStream. And so in SQL Server 2008 release 2, they added that feature. Basically, if you had a FileStream column or a FileStream file group at all and tried to turn transaction isolation on, it wouldn't let you do it in the entire database. So now you can in 2008 release 2. In 2012, they also added some more features for FileStream. One of the features was called multiple containers for FileStream. I got 38 minutes. And I got this one wrong in a blog entry, and so I want to show you what multiple containers per file group means. So I actually said that this was multiple file stream containers per database. And somebody corrected me on the internet and said, no, not per database. You could always do that. And I thought, I've never done that. Let me try. So there's this nice thing in SQL Server Management Studio called the Template Explorer, if you've ever used the Template Explorer. I kind of like the Template Explorer every once in a while. Where is it? I have to explore where it is, though. There we are. Okay, and someplace in the Template Explorer is something to do with file streams. I bet it's database. There's database. And over here, there's a create database with file stream. Okay, so let's do a template for that. So up comes the template. And sure enough, this same template came up on my 2008 release 2 machine, and there's two file groups for file stream. So you could always do that. That was not a big deal. Right, and this works. Let me just replace the file stream template parameters here so I can, or I'm sorry, the template parameters for this sample database. That's fine. All right, good. So we'll replace them. Now I've got actual code that I can run. Now, this part would work in SQL 2008 release 2, SQL 2008, or SQL 2012. The part that is new for SQL Server 2012 is that you can have a file group with more than one place to put the files. So I can put the files in sample database underscore 4 and also put the files in another subdirectory called sample database underscore 5. In fact, let me kludge this one to make sure that I can do it real quick-like. Okay, name equals that, that equals that. Okay, so we, I believe, need, see if I did this last time. That's right, do the demos on the fly. It's always way more fun. Every time they fail, I learn something. Okay, so here we have 5. And we'll put a 5 over here. And hopefully these are all separated by that. And the only thing I don't know right offhand is where the parentheses go. So let's try making the parentheses go there. So everybody okay? Understand that means multiple containers. So multiple containers per file group. You can specify for a certain file group, I'd like some of the files stored over here and some of the files stored over there. Just like you can with a regular file group for database. So now that I've said that, go for it. Invalid usage of name. Okay, good. So we'll do this then, because obviously it was something I screwed up. We'll put this over here, and put another one over here, and we'll put another one over here, and see what happens. Okay, and if this doesn't work, I'll give up. Ready? And one comma over there. Good. And no comma at the end. Go. Good for me. All right. I know I got it right because it's taken a long time to do. There we go. So that's what's meant by multiple containers. It's multiple containers per file group. I could always have more than one file group, each with its own container, in SQL Server 2008. Okay. I fixed the blog entry, by the way. There's also up to 5x read improvement. And you think to yourself, this is a file system. How can they ever get any read improvement out of a file system? Well, it turns out there's a new flavor of SMB. That's the server message block protocol that they use for files, called SMB3. I think that's right, because SMB2 is the current one. And basically what they're getting is they're getting the percentage improvement by using SMB3 protocol rather than SMB2 protocol. Oh, good for them. Linear scaling with multiple threads. So SQL Server is aware of the fact that you're using multiple threads. And this is the biggest deal in 2012. In SQL 2008, 2008 release 2, FileStream couldn't use database mirroring. If you were running with database mirroring for, for the ability to have your database crash and then get it over on the other side, you know, over there to be able to fail over. Failover is the word I was thinking of. If you're using with failover, you couldn't have FileStream. And if you had FileStream, you couldn't have failover. So in SQL Server 2005, they introduced a really neat feature called Always On. And Always On basically uses Windows clustering to be a more enhanced version of what database mirroring used to do. That's really all it is. And it uses Windows clustering. So I've actually set up a Windows cluster with a FileStream on it, and sure enough, you can actually support this with Always On. So you can go into Always On and you can say, fail this over to the other side. And in fact, I've even failed it over to the other side in the middle of editing something, right? And it fails over okay. Very weird. I wish I had the cycles to show you that one. But anyway, now it is supported with the reliability and availability feature called Always On. Everybody okay with that one? That's a big deal. Most people that wouldn't use FileStream wouldn't use it because it didn't support database mirroring. And by the way, it still doesn't support database mirroring. It just supports Always On. So you have to have 2012 as Always On. The other thing that sort of slipped in there, and I had to try this because I didn't believe it the first time somebody said it, and it's not docked in the books online correctly either, is that you can specify a max size for FileStream containers. The max size is so that you don't fill up the entire SQL Server disk with files, right? And so specifying max size prevents you from doing that, and then you just run out of space, which is at least better than filling up the entire SQL Server C drive with files, which is probably not what I want to do. Everybody okay with that? FileStream. But the good thing about FileStream is the data was on the file system and it looked like SQL controlled it. In fact, it was. It was integrated with backup and restore and SQL Server security. One of the things with FileStream is in order to be able to use FileIO, you actually have to be using a Windows login. Because what it does is it actually takes your access to the table with the FileStream column and it uses that access to control whether or not you can get the file using FileIO. Don't ask me how they do that. It's basically implemented as a lower level device driver that installs when SQL Server installs. And you can use transactional streaming I/O for performance. The streaming I/O is better than the native SQL I/O in order to deal with these file stream columns, which is why you'd go through the whole rigmarole of getting a transaction handle and a SQL handle and all this good stuff. Yes, sir?
What's the difference in performance?
So the difference in performance? You mean it depends on what you're doing with it. So if you're doing direct insert, one of the things that SQL Server doesn't have a way to do is it doesn't have a way to insert blobs, right? It always streams the blob over in little chunks across the network because of the TDS protocol. when you're using file I/O, it can be much, much faster. And I won't give you a number. I'll just point to Paul's white paper. He has nice graphs and colorful charts and stuff that shows how fast it goes. With reading, and by the way, that's not the only thing about it that's good, is the performance. The other thing is you're not dragging those buffers through SQL Server's buffer pool. You start dragging the buffers through SQL Server's buffer pool, you might be clearing the buffer pool a whole lot, and things aren't going to stay in the buffer pool and the system isn't going to run fast. But as far as the performance, it's actually faster. And it's faster yet once they started using the SMB3 protocol. Okay. But the problem with this is you just saw what the files looked like. How do I open these up? How do I read them in Notepad? How do I use like any program other than one I wrote myself? Right? I'm not going to write SharePoint in my spare time. So how do I write a program to actually use this thing? And by the way, you might have noticed, it's a flat file system. When you make up a file stream in a container, it's going to make up one directory. There are no nesting of file systems in FileStream. Right? So there's no way you can get anything but a flat directory structure, right? If I go and look on my system right now, what I have is a flat directory structure. There is no way to tell this guy to make a subdirectory of this. It just doesn't have a concept of subdirectory. And so even if you knew what was in those files, somebody has to keep track of what exactly those files used to be before you put them in there, because now they're completely unintelligible. Okay, so this was the main drawback of FileStream. It doesn't use the Win32 APIs. So, of course, they had to come up with a good idea for this. Like I said, I think they might not have had it finished by 2008. So in 2005, they made up file table. And file table is basically using FileStream for its underlying storage, but they've written their own what's called namespace owner. Did you know you could write your own namespace owner for the file system? And they made up their own namespace owner so that what this looks like to you is it looks like a share on your machine. Cool or what? Right? So it's built over the FileStream feature. So it really is storing files with those weird names in FileStream. But what they do is they put extra metadata in this file table so it looks to you, and as far as the system goes, looks to the system. And what I mean by the system is I mean the operating system. Antivirus stuff looks at this and goes, oh, you have a zip file, right? So it looks to the file system as though it's a real file system share. In fact, let me show it to you. It's much more impressive when I do that. It also allows you to use these with existing applications. Cool. So I can open the text file in Notepad. So I could open the JPEG file with a JPEG viewer. Great, that's what I want to be able to do. However, the Windows file system is not intrinsically transactional. And if it is transactional, we're not going to do distributed transactions between SQL Server and the file system. So they have non-transactional access that they can use to access this. In other words, it's layered over FileStream. So if you wanted to access it through the FileStream way, you could do it within a transaction. If you don't have a program that you wrote yourself that actually does transactions, then you could access it non-transactionally. And it does keep track of all this information, and it does hold some locks in the database when you do non-transactional access. But obviously, it isn't point-in-time recoverable. In fact, the point-in-time recoverability feature basically says, if you're doing non-transactional access and you fail and you restore something, you might have extra files. You're not going to lose any files, but you might have extra files. Because it turns out even if you delete these FileStream files, they don't get deleted until you run another couple of checkpoints and a backup. So you won't lose these files, but you may have more than you think you do. Everybody okay with that so far? Okay. And the other thing it doesn't have is a hierarchical namespace. So they built one. Really? They built one how? They built one with something you may have heard of that you wondered why it was there, called the hierarchy ID data type. Is this starting to all sort of come together now? So they made up this file stream feature that not anybody uses, and this hierarchy ID data type that very few people used, and everybody said, why did you waste your time? And then they bring in the file table with the hierarchical thing that looks like a file system, and oh, that's why you did it. And then tomorrow we're going to do property search over this, and now you have full text search with property search, which is basically part of WinFS at least. But I'm not allowed to say that, apparently. I just did. All right, so let's make a file table. So, we go in here, And the first thing we have to do, in fact, I have a file table demo, so let me just do that so I don't wander around. That's scripts. And this one I wrote myself. It's really easy. It doesn't do any full text search because I was saving that for tomorrow. All right. So this is file table demo, simple. And basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a database called file table demo on primary. This is where the MDF file lives, and I do have a files directory already. And this is where the file stream container lives. And notice the file stream container, in this case, I'm having live in the same place as the MDF file. Not any reason other than I was lazy. And then I say, with file stream, non-transacted access equals full. That doesn't mean that you have to access it non-transactionally. It means you can. You can also have non-transacted access read-only, which means you can only do read-only non-transacted access. You can't update it except for transactionally. Or you can have non-transacted access equals none, in which case you'll be able to see the files, but you won't be able to use them with real programs, only programs you wrote yourself. Now, because this is supposed to emulate a directory structure, I'm going to create a database with a directory name. And this is used to synthesize the name of the share that they make up when you make up a file stream. Ready for this? Okay. So there. Okay, what do I have now? So let's do what we did before and go out and look in the file system under C, Files, File Table Demo. There it is. And notice I have the MDF, the LDF, and I have the container. There's the container. And lo and behold, this is just file stream. Well, sure. So we got to get something better out of it than that. So to get something better out of it than that, let's make a file table. So we use this database, and we'll make a file table. Now, you can't make a file table out of a real table, unfortunately. The way that you make a file table is you say, create file table foo, right? In my case, I'm calling it documents. And then you just say, as file table. The file table itself has a fixed schema, and so I'm going to go over all the schema stuff to it later on. But good, now I've made a file table name with file table. Now, where does this fit in my directory structure? Well, notice this says that this directory is going to live under documents. Documents under where? Well, documents under file tab demo. Okay, so the path to it is going to be something, something, file tab demo, documents. And I should just be able to put it there. Now, the way that I used to do this demo, because I'm not a GUI guy, and notice I very rarely use Object Explorer. In fact, apparently the Utility Explorer got in there. It's obnoxious, the Utility Explorer. Stop that. I'm going to use that tomorrow for my DAC talk. I have a talk on DAC tomorrow, and they use that with the utility. So anyway, if you don't know what the utility is, go to that when I get 23 minutes. Let's go. So, okay. So now I should be able to see under my databases. Let's refresh them. There we go. And under there, there's a database called File Stream Demo. There it is, File Tab Demo. And then under tables, notice I have now system tables, file tables, and real tables. Well, I don't have any real tables in that database, but I do have a file table. So under file table, there's my name of my file table. And lo and behold, found out something new last week, or I think it was more like a month ago. You can right-click on it and then say, explore file table directory. And it will allow you to see the directory. There's the directory. Now, where does that directory live? Well, that directory lives on a synthesized network share. My name of my machine is ZMV03. So it looks like it lives under network ZMV03 / MS SQL Server, the name of the SQL Server, right, instance you're running, because you could have two or three instances of SQL Server. So name of your machine / name of the SQL Server instance / name of the directory that you specified in the create database statement, right, which is file tab demo, / name of the directory you specified in the file table creation statement. Right, so let's go back and look. File tab demo documents. Okay, so there we have over here file tab demo, which was in my create database statement, and documents, which was in my file table directory. Great. So what does that mean? Well, that really means I have a network share. If I didn't want to use this Q utility, I could go down here and I could type in whack whack ZMV03. And by the way, it should complete by this point. There it is right there, SQL Server, because of course I've done this before, right? No, I'm not going to do the demo untested. Okay, so whack whack ZMV03. Did I just misspell ZMV03? Probably. V03. Whack And then we'll just select this one off of here. And there's my directory. And it basically looks like any old network share. So can I use it like any old network share? Yeah, let's do that. So what am I going to do here? Well, I'm going to make a new file. And let's make a new text file. And we'll create this file and call it sumfile.txt because I have no imagination whatsoever. And there's the sumfile.txt. And it's right there. And can I open that file? Sure I can. So there I open the file in Notepad. It retained, or it looked like it retained its suffix. So did it really retain its suffix? No, under the covers there's all this junk in the file stream directory like there always was. They just layered these names on top of it. It's completely synthetic. So can I actually type something in here? Yes, yeah, some data. And it works just fine. Save it. However, this only works up to a certain point there. So I've done it with Notepad. Now double-click on it to open it. Oh, and what does it say? This request is not supported. Why is it not supported? Notepad uses memory map files. So the thing they couldn't put in here was support for memory map files. So because I'm opening it as a network share on my local machine, it won't let me open this as a memory map file. But that's easily fixed. Let's map a drive to it. So if we map a drive to it, so let's go to the real file system. And actually, where's the real file system? We'll go to the real file system over here, and we'll say network, map network drive, and we'll map whack ZMV03, whack MS SQL Server, hopefully I'm typing this all right, file tab underscore demo, whack documents. Actually, let's map it to the SQL Server. That's just as easy. There, then there's a few things I can misspell. So, go. Okay, now I've got a directory mapped to a drive name. Let's go in there again, one more time. Now that I'm in through the network, rather than through a like pseudo network share that was really on my own machine, now that I'm in through the network, yes, there, works fine. So you can't use memory map files from your own machine, but there's nothing that says you can't pretend it's a network share and use them like that. So let's add some more data in there. Some more data. Okay, fine. And then close it. Great, that's it. So you can put anything you want in there. And so the first thing I had somebody ask me about this is, can you use bulk copy with this? And my answer to that is, why would you? Right? Because the file table has a fixed schema. You can't put any more information in those other schema positions. Those are kept track of by this thing. And so rather than use bulk copy, why don't we just insert some things like this? So I think on my temp directory I have some. Okay, there we go. And SQL Server white papers. And so let's just cut and paste SQL Server white papers. And we'll also retain the directory structure as well. So there's the SQL Server white papers. We'll copy these in. We'll paste them into the Y drive under here, under there. And if I paste them in, there. Now they're in the file system controlled by the database. And if I want to double-click on these, well, Word doesn't use memory map files, so we're okay with this. Okay? And it turns out that now, because it's SQL Server table, I can basically select against the SQL Server table. Where am I? Okay, so let's select against the SQL Server table. Select star from documents. Notice it's taking a little bit longer now because there's some big documents. There's the document right there. Everybody okay with that? Now, just to make sure that nobody's got this wrong, including me, let's go back and look in my file system under the C drive and see what we have here. We have files. We have file tab demo, which is where we were. We still have the MDF and the LDF file in the container. When we go back to the container, GUID, they're still the same old names. Somebody's keeping track of that stuff, and who is it? It's SQL Server. And what's SQL Server doing? It's populating this table, this file table. If you look at what's in the file table, let's go look at what's in the file table. There is a stream ID. I bet that's the GUID that they need, sure. And there is a column called file underscore stream, which is where the data lives. They actually keep track of the name of the file, the path locator for the file, and the parent path for the file. Well, I understand what name is. That makes sense, right? But what is this thing? Path locator, that's a hierarchy ID. So basically, the way that they can synthesize what looks like a hierarchical looking file system is by using their own hierarchy ID. And again, where did hierarchy ID come from? The WinFS team, right? So now we have a synthesized file system. And we can just drag and drop files in there. We can open them with the right programs, and it works just hunky-dory fine. There's how it knows what file type it is. And SQL Server is keeping track of all of this stuff. Now, if you really have a table that you want to tie to this, you can tie the table to this by actually using perhaps the stream ID or perhaps the file name. And you can tie that to another table that contains additional metadata about the documents if you'd like to store additional metadata in there. In other words, there is no alter table foo to file table, which just adds all the file table columns. There's just make a new file table, and then if we can, hook it up to a table we already have that contains additional data. Now, this is something at least that I can use, right? And as far as I'm concerned, you can point your web server at it, and it will now serve, you know, pictures off of it if you'd like to do that, right? But this is all non-transactional access because there's no transactional web servers I know of. Watch the Linux people probably write one, right? Okay. Everybody okay with these? So let's go back to slides. I got 14 minutes. This is good. I'll actually get through this one. Okay. So the file table is a fixed format file in 2005. It uses file stream storage, as we've seen. The hierarchy ID columns present data as a synthesized hierarchical file system share. And like I said, they wrote a piece of code that's called namespace owner for the file system. And actually, you can see this in some of the extended events they use for it. It's available as a file share or as a transact SQL table. And by the way, if you bring SQL Server down, the file share goes away, right? The only reason why that file share just sort of appears out there in the distance is because SQL Server is synthesizing it in front of your eyes. So you have to have SQL Server up to make this work. You can maintain it, though, by just maintaining the share. You can put your own new files there. You can edit them there. You can drag and drop them there, and it works just fine. Preserves the file name and the suffix that you use and allows non-transactional access. So we can use programs like Notepad and Word to be able to view these things. To set it up, it requires file stream as a prerequisite, obviously. You alter the database to, one, allow non-transactional access, and two, specify a share name. That's the name that they're going to use in their synthetic share. Then you create table as file table. Notice you can't have any additional columns or computed columns or anything. You specify the file table directory for that table. So if I had two file tables in the same database, file table one and file table two, they'd have different directories. You can specify the collation for the name column. That's the file name. So if you're actually putting them in there in, I forget what this is called, big something or other, Chinese collation, you can actually put Chinese collation names in your file system. And they'll keep track of those names in the right collation. Cool. There's no partitioning for file tables, so it does not support the partition table feature of SQL Server. And the file access is basically whack whack machine whack share name, where the share name is the instance of SQL Server, whack DB directory, which is the directory that you specified in your create database, whack file table directory. Everybody okay with that one? All right. So file table behaviors, it's a fixed format. You can't add columns to it. It has a bunch of system-defined constraints and defaults. In fact, it has so many defaults that you can basically insert a file into a file table in SQL by just specifying the file name and the contents of the file. So if I go and look in this particular database here, in fact, let me just look under file tables. There's my file table over here. We'll have a look at the constraints on file table. There's all the constraints on and defaults on file table. So there's a constraint and a default on almost every column in there because they're keeping track of that stuff themselves. There's a limit to what you can specifically do through SQL. Okay, and so of course I had to explore what that limit was. It allows user-defined indexes. You can put extra indexes on the file table if you want to. You can put in user-defined constraints if you want to specifically constrain on top of what their constraints are. So I can't name a file with my own name, something like that. You can also specify user-defined triggers, and I don't have time to do that demo in 10 minutes, but basically now I can actually make a trigger that triggers on, say, update. I can open a file in Notepad, update it, and when I close the file in Notepad, it now hits the trigger, just like it should have in the first place, right, according to the guy who asked me that. Right, now that I've exposed it to the file system, it's no longer SQL Server specific. But SQL Server is hooked into it all the way. How come? Well, SQL Server has to maintain all that metadata right in the file table. It's at least going to update the last access day and the last updated date. Right, has to be able to do that. So why can't it fire your trigger? And it turns out it can. I have a trigger in there if you want to try it. There's the columns in file table. And of course, you can imagine that they're the columns that you would see inside the file system. Right. The only one that's kind of weird is, file stream, which is where the actual data lives, and the stream ID, which is the unique identifier for file stream. All the rest of them are things that you would find in a file system. And by the way, you would have things for directories as well. Directory would have, is directory equals true? So you have directories and files, and you can have as many subdirectories, synthesized subdirectories, as you would like. In transact SQL access, basically inserts a lot of columns use defaults. So the first thing I wanted to do was see in 10 minutes. I want to go over again. I'm not allowed to go over twice in the same day. What I wanted to see was what I could do with this in transact SQL. So where was I doing this? Sorry, I'm just scrolling way past it. Okay. Oh, come on, better than this. Can you just look for insert, Bob? There we go. So here's all I have to do an insert. Insert DBO documents, and the only two fields I care about is name and file stream, right? I'm not even going to give it a suffix, but I could give it a suffix. And then the name is actually going to be, it computes the suffix, synthetic file.txt. And basically what synthetic file.txt is it's a zero-length file. Notice it has an empty string as the, or an empty byte array as the file. Ready? Let's make a file in SQL. Cool. It's there. Can I go and open synthetic file.txt and update it in Notepad? Sure. So there it's over here tied to a share, so I can update it in Notepad. There under documents is, where is it? Synthetic file.txt right at the very bottom. And if I opened it, he said, there we go, in Notepad, I could fill in some synthetic data, which I type in myself. There. And close it and save it. And there it is. And it gets backed up by SQL Server. So this is actually more of a file system database hybrid than the other one is, by far, right? It's okay, but what did I do? I just invented a file at the root of the directory. Well, what if I wanted to put one in a subdirectory? So I want to be able to make one inside of a subdirectory. And the problem with that is that I actually tried at one point to specify the path locator, and it turned out the path locator is a computed column. And so I can't set the path because they're going to compute it. So what I did, and you can follow this, I actually wrote a blog entry about it because I'm not going to do it in 8 minutes. But what I did was look up the default, and this is the way they figure out what the value of the hierarchy ID should be. This stuff right here. So what I did was I just copied their default, right? And it's basically based on a random number generator, a random GUID generator, new ID over here. So I just said, okay. To make one, what I need is I need a subdirectory called SQL Server. Do I have one over here? Hopefully I made one. All right, so let's make a directory called SQL Server. Because, of course, everybody wants to make files in SQL Server. And now that I've got a directory from named SQL Server, I can get the path locator to string from documents where name is SQL Server, and path locator get level is equal to 1. That's hierarchy ID code for I want it to exist at the root, right? Everybody okay with that? And then I would insert the new path as this path string. I basically copied it out of their own defaults and then use that to insert a document called sub synthetic file 2, which is going to live under the SQL Server directory, all in SQL. Ready? Go. So there. So now I've got it. So if I go look under the SQL Server directory, isn't this fun? Then you can see subsynthetic file 2. So I can actually make up a file that lives under a directory that I want it to. I suppose cool, but not really tremendously interesting. Okay. Can I update directory? Can I move it from one directory to another? No, but you could actually go out and get the directory you want to move it to, and there's a nice hierarchy ID method called what? somebody at 5 in the afternoon or whatever this is, tell me what the hierarchy ID method is for this. Oh, come on, he said. It's called, apparently I'm not doing this right. Okay. It's actually called, reparent hierarchy or something like that. And so reparent hierarchy just takes the hierarchy ID of the old hierarchy, the higher ID of the new hierarchy, and just moves it from one place to another. So basically who they invented the hierarchy ID for was this, I think. And you can do this with hierarchy IDs yourself. Not very interesting. Like, you would really not want to do it yourself this way. But you could also do it just with non-transactional file system, and you're all set. And then you don't have to worry about, so what program do I use to open this? And why doesn't it hit the trigger and all these other things? All right, let's finish this up. I don't know why. Like I said, anybody would want to use BCP, but you could use BCP. There is no write method on update. Remember, the var binary max has a write method. You can't use the write method on a file stream-based file. And select into does not create a file table. So if you want to just take the information, move it elsewhere, select into will create a regular table. Of course, now it's no longer maintained as a file table, and you can't make a regular table into a file table. So I don't think that's tremendously useful, but it works that way. Oh, and this was a weird one, too. Delete fails on directories containing directories or files. So if I delete an empty directory, that works fine through SQL. But if I delete a directory that has files in it through SQL, they're not going to pop up a box that says, do you want to delete all these too? They just fail, right? And yeah, I've tried it just to make sure it works that way. Triggers, file with SQL or file IO. There's some limitations to triggers, and you can read these off the list if you want to. Right, I'm going to hand out the slides. Now, the functions, I think, are kind of interesting because Transact SQL built-in functions allow for portable code. You can get the file namespace path, and basically that gets you a path for every file, and you can get that through SQL, just like you could get path locator. File table root path gives you the root of the file table, and the root of the table file table would be rooted someplace in the database part of the file system. And then get path locator retrieves a hierarchy ID for UNC name. And that was kind of a hard one for me to understand. So let me show you. I have 3 minutes and 35 seconds. Okay. Let me show you how somewhat of that works. This was all the stuff that I skimmed by before. And the interesting part of this, at least to me, okay, here we go. So I'm going to get the file stream namespace path of the file directory called SQL Server. And what I want to make sure it's at level 1, so it's the SQL Server, because they could have the same name, right? It could have a subdirectory under the SQL Server directory called SQL Server. Which one would it get? So I have to have the one that's at level 1 in the hierarchy, and then that the descendant is level 1 as well. So let me just go get that. And when I do get that, oh, that's not very useful at all. This actually gives me the file stream path name, gives me the entire synthesized path. The one I'm looking for that is fairly interesting, he said. Scrolling for 2 minutes and 51 seconds. Okay, you can read the blog entry as well. Okay, here's the one where I attempt to get everything. So get file stream namespace path actually takes no parameters or a 1. If I give it a 1, it actually comes up with a full path. If I give it nothing, it comes up with a relative path. Everybody okay with that? The file table root path of DBO documents just gives you the path of where the documents directory is in the synthetic file system. And get path locator was no great shakes either. But path name is kind of interesting. Path name is the file stream path name back to the original path. And the reason why I want to do this in the first place is I want to show you what path name looks like. Ready? Go. All right. So path locator, big deal, it's a GUID, who knows, or it's a hierarchy ID, who knows what that is. File path, there's the relative path. Here's the full path. Notice this is the path that you would use to read this in a program. This is the path that I got from the file system. Or you can just connect to the share and read it, right? There is no need to go to SQL Server for this. But this one, path locator, there it is. This one is kind of strange, file stream path. Because it turns out if I can look at this file stream path, if I can move this stuff over enough to look at it, stop that. Let me just copy and paste it in. Copy, paste. What you'll see in here is that the real name of the file stream path, according to SQL Server, is not even the name that they tell you. If I was to go look for it using the file stream feature, it's ZMV3 WAC SQL Server. That's fine. What's this thing? Version 2 of the file stream feature itself. Because, by the way, SQL 2008 will return you V01 of the file stream feature. So now that we have the file stream feature version 2, it actually made that part of the path. File table demo, DBO docs, and then, sorry, file stream. And here's the real outrageous path for this thing, right? And it even has a volume hint for a specific hard drive. This is so, and I've actually done this, right, in an always-on situation. Turn on always-on, mirror it to both sides of an always-on cluster, open the file. Now, opening the file doesn't actually lock the file for most of the programs that you use. Notepad, for example, doesn't lock a file. Then I failed it over. And what happened when I failed it over is during failed over, it actually presented me with a message box that says, Notepad has lost track of where that file was. And then when it actually failed over to the other side, Notepad got it back again. And I just saved what I had typed in before I failed over. And that was the trippiest thing I've ever seen. Okay, so anyway, that's basically how it works with clusters. I have 0 minutes again. Good. So there's a couple more things that I have. So file tables support full text search and semantic search. And I'm going to do full text search and semantic search with them tomorrow. You can use the file table metadata yourself in SQL queries to look for a set of rows and then open them with file system if you want to. File share tables, it's a real Windows share. Even the antivirus programs think it's real. It uses the SMB protocol, and it's 139. I lied when I said 149. You have to open up port 139, which is the resolver, and 445, which is the SMB file share. You cannot layer file table on an existing share, unfortunately. Right? I would like to be able to say, here's 500 files, just point to these. But you can't do that. You have to say, here's an empty share, and we'll drag them all over. Not a big deal, but it was a pain to me. Memory map files aren't supported. The other big memory map file is paint. There is a 15-level subdirectory limit in this, and the Windows Explorer actually has a 260-byte limit on the names. However, both the real NTFS file system and this feature can allow more than that. So if you actually want to limit things to 250-character names, you have to enforce that yourself, because the real NTFS can have names up to 1,024, I believe. But Windows Explorer only knows about the first 260. Transactional access, you can access them transactionally if you would like to, but it does not permit transactional MTFS calls. There is such a thing as transactional NTFS, and they do not support that. Locking, so you can see locks for this. Let's just open it and see some locks. Sorry, it's the last thing of the day, right? If you guys want to leave, feel free to do. Right, so here's what I want to do. This is my last demo, I promise. Huh, didn't I say that before? Don't believe anything I say. Oh, but you just said that. Yeah, don't believe that either. Okay, so this is locks taken. So it says in the books online that you can go get non-transactional handles. They look like that. And notice the non-transactional handles I have open are against the server root again, the database root, and the table root. How come? Because I have Windows Explorer open twice, pointing at this thing. Once over here, and once over here, and actually once pointing right to the file stream. I don't know if that would help. So when I close those things, there's only two non-transactional handles, and that's for the server root. So what I figured I would do, and I tried this last night, and it was a good thing I did, is to go into here, there's my Y drive, and open a file up with Notepad, he said. And when I open the file in, where's the Notepad? There we go, in the root. Now I should have a lock there. So let's go look at my non-transactional handles again. Well, notice I've got database root, table root, table root, but I don't see anything about table. What happened to the lock on the table? I have it opened in Notepad, right? Well, this comes to, Bob doesn't know much about file IO apparently, because if I open a file in Notepad, there's nothing that says that somebody else can't come and open that file again. Right? So there are no locks on the table. So I actually had to go as far as to write myself just to prove that this worked. Right? In my C drive, there's a thing called File IO Exclusive Access, about halfway down that list there. And so if you bring up a console app, And do FileIO exclusive access, is it exclusive access or exclusive? FileIO exclusive, which basically opens the file of your choice in exclusive access, which means I have to do this junk. Okay, this is MS SQL Server, and this is a good test of how Bob can type. File tab demo documents, and then what's the name of a file? Goodness. Synthetic file or something? Didn't I have that? Well, let's go find out, because I'm too lazy to look. How about some file? Okay. So, somefile.txt. Okay. So, oh, temp. Temp, if you could spell it right, works well. Okay. So now let's go back to here. And there. Ooh. Exception could not find a good Bob. Your error handling is wonderful. Could not find a part of the path. Thank you. I'm glad you saw that. Okay. Worked last night when I wrote it. Go. Okay. So basically all it does is open the file for exclusive access, read about 100 bytes, and say press any key to continue. So now let's see what I have for locks. There. Now I have one against, see that, table item. So you are actually locking a row in the database by actually doing non-transactional access to that, because it has to enforce the file system's access to it. Everybody okay with that? And so now if I wanted to open it again, it'd say it's in use, like you're used to in Windows. Okay, but actually I had to write that myself. This thing from the books online also doesn't work all that great. This only works if the file is in some other directory other than the root, or you have it open yourself. Luckily, I have it open myself here. So don't expect that to work either. Okay. And I think we're about done. So let's go and finish this up and see if there's any questions that go home for the day. This supports S-locks for reading, X-locks for writing, and allows, NTFS op-locks, which is apparently the NTFS locking system. Concurrency, it's read-committed semantics if you're using non-transactional access. And during read-committed snapshot or snapshot isolation transaction, it just doesn't work because they can't enforce those semantics on it. It won't refuse to be installed. It just fails to open. Okay. Security is based on Transact SQL security, which means that you have access to the table, and giving you access to the table gives you access on all the files in the table. And does SQL Server have row-level security? It does not. So therefore, you can't have access on individual files through this feature. Everybody okay with that? Until they support row-level security. Also, auditing works on file system tables, but they pointed out in the books online that if you have Word open a file, Word actually opens the file, makes a copy of that file, translates one file to another, and you're going to get an audit row for every one of those. So it could be a little wordier than you might like. Metadata, so I can say sys_tables where file table equals one. Database file stream options gives me what file stream options I have, and system defined objects. Diagnosis and management, there's actually an entire extended event series over this thing, which is where I found NSO and had to go figure out what that was. You can also kill non-transaction handles if you need the database for yourself, which is nice. And there are perfmon counters for this stuff. So all the diagnostics you could possibly want. End of the day, end of the day. So what did they do? They decided it was better off to store files in the file system than in the database, but they wanted them controlled by the database. So they made it this feature. They might have not have been able to finish it the first time, so they gave you half of it, right? And then they gave you the supporting other half, which was hierarchy ID. Then in this release, they put them all together, and it looks like a real file system. Cool or what? Well, maybe not as cool as it could be at the end of the day. Does anybody have any questions? Good. Well, then yes, sir. Oh, okay. So the performance to increase the, so his question was, it took 9 seconds for that, what did I have, like 50 or 60 files in there? How is it when you have 10,000 files? And the idea was that I read the contents of every single file in there, which is something you probably don't want to do in real life. but this read the contents of all the files. There's a couple ways in Paul's white paper that you can make it run faster. One of the ways that you should make it run faster is that when you store a file in the NTFS file system, it automatically makes up an 8.3 name for that file. If you don't care about the 8.3 name, then turn that off. You can turn that off at the NTFS level. But it's actually fairly quick considering what SQL Server can do. That thing was reading them through Transact SQL. If I read them by file IO, it was almost instantaneous. So yeah, they're slower in SQL Server than would be if you stored them in a database, but not that much slower. They're much faster if you read them through the file system. And you want to turn off some of the NTFS settings so you don't get additional metadata garbage that you may or may not need. Any other questions? Okay, then I hereby declare time for the party, or whatever it was supposed to be tonight. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And I'll see you tomorrow, hopefully, for some of the stuff I'm doing then. Hopefully, maybe. We'll see.